follow the words because when you listen, it's hard to understand. So first one is band seven. It's called I Ain't Gonna Let Nobody Turn Me Round. Oh, sorry, band three. It's where the people are standing in this long line. That page. So band three, Ain't Gonna Let Nobody Turn Me Round, and keep your fingers crossed so the electricity lasts through the song.
Sorry.
No, it's not free, right? It's just following the words and listening.
I'm standing
it's smart
in the
smart
line.
I just sing this.
Keep on.
Is oftentimes they were instructions on how to escape.
a classic song is the one, Follow the Drinking Gourd. I don't know if many of you heard that one. Those were instructions on how to follow the Underground Railroad.
When the first sun sets, follow the Drinking Gourd. The Drinking Gourd being the dipper. So, way to get on the railroad to the north, up to Canada. Yeah, I learned it in fourth grade. It was the only Black song that was in my songbook, and I didn't know how heavy duty it was until about 15 years later, and all of a sudden I realized it was a Escape to Freedom Underground Railroad song.
I was down in Mississippi 2 summers ago, walking around some of the Black neighborhoods. I distinctly remember at least twice little girls, 3, 4 years old, maybe older than that, 4 or 5, whatever, standing there. I remember one girl was standing on top of their picnic table in front of their house, just kind of dancing to herself, singing, just blaring out the song. It was just incredible. She was so good.
Yeah.
Little girl singing is very common.
Following up on what Theo said, I just pulled a paragraph out of here. Two little girls, the ones that were singing, outside in the backyards, I just passed other youngsters engaged in their game called State Trooper, in which half the number lined up, locked arms, and proceeded to march singing We Shall Overcome, then were set upon and beat down by the others wielding sticks and branches. In situations like these, one must observe the tragedy that the misdeeds of our society are imprinted in the minds of the children.
Also, the second song, looking at that picture, you're talking about Uncle Tom. Charlie. My roommate worked out in the country, and he saw a lot of what he called the Cotton Patch Blacks. Cotton Belt South is where I worked, and they're living the life of a slave. Out there, living in the little shacks, and given a car by a landowner or something, and then they work for that landowner. I mean, they are living the same life that their ancestors living 100 years ago, 150 years ago. I was talking to a friend of mine, a guy who's in the Air Force. He's about 45 now. And he was back in the same town I was 20 years ago for training, and cadet training. And he talked about, like, one time he went to a high school game there, football game, and they played Dixie. And one time we went out fishing with these two old guys, and they talked about the time when they strung up the nigger on that tree over there. And it was scary.
Yeah, what you're talking about, Theo, is really kind of interesting because most of us think, oh yeah, right, that's sort of the thing of the past. They don't do that stuff anymore. Not so.
Well, it's kind of interesting, you know, we think the South is so far away from us and stuff like that, but did you guys know that in the Pacific Northwest, Stanwood is one of the head of the neo-Nazi groups? They have meetings there every week for neo-Nazism, and it's pretty scary, and there's a lot of things going on, so it's not far from home.
Okay, how about a switch? In terms of notebooks, Lori and I had a suggestion regarding comments. First of all, any questions?
There is no one better here to talk about that sort of issue than Elmer, who has written a book on, I think the title was God and Sexuality. So we thought it'd be real neat if he could come and talk to us about that very issue to sort of help lead a discussion, hear some things, give us his point of view and stuff. So it's strictly voluntary, but 2:30 on Wednesday, right here in this very spot, he's going to come and kind of lead a discussion. My recommendation is that all of you be here, but it is not required for the course. Although I expect it will be very stimulating, and I imagine it will move off and do various and sundry other tangential issues that are important to you guys one way or another. He's an amazingly open, sincere, and knowledgeable man who has a great skill and wealth of information to relate to us all. I'm looking forward to it personally. A little bit awkward, but you guys did real well by yourselves. In fact, you guys talked a lot better without us than I think you do with us. Made us feel that maybe what we ought to do is just post a list of assignments and subjects that you might consider talking about, and then you never see us ever again. What did you think about that experiment last week?
It's great. It's good.
Does everybody universally feel that way?
First half of the discussion, I felt we talked in circles.
Yeah.
And it's really frustrating.
Why were you talking in circles, do you think?
We didn't pick any direction. We just kind of started talking. Or we were religion. I always talk in circles. We talk about religion.
That's certainly a good subject to explore. Not religion, but why one talks in circles when they talk about it. But maybe we should avoid that for a moment.
Oh, what are you snickering about?
In the second half, not everybody was there, so with a smaller group, we had some questions to start off with. It kind of keeps on track.
I didn't know we were being recorded at first.
I think small group helped, though.
I think the first one, we didn't consciously. The second half, we consciously made sure we didn't go in circles, because the first half, we went in circles so much, it was frustrating, that we consciously made an effort and we were thinking about it. And we had some questions, something like, this is what we want to do. Write down some questions, had some questions written down, and we knew that was our goal to get them done, so that we had a goal to go toward instead of just, let's talk.
But everybody got so excited that they all talked at the same time. Most of the team.
I think that part of the problem, the first part was that, I mean, I for one was afraid of stepping on other people's toes. You know, when you talk about religion, it's their personal deal, and you know, and you want to have yours, you figure you should let other people have theirs, and if you didn't understand something, you know, you didn't agree with it, you don't go, you know, what the hell are you talking about? That doesn't even make sense. Because if it's theirs, you know, then, and so you're like, I was afraid to step on toes, and I think that's part, for me, why the first half was dragged. But in the second part, you know, so we had a little more, I mean, it wasn't like we disagreed, but you know, we could talk about, you know, I don't think it was that way because of this and that. You have to feel bad because you didn't know the person. Do you know what I mean? So that was part of what religion was.
Christine, I saw you shrug your shoulders when I asked if people thought it was a good idea that we abandoned ship that day. Did you disagree?
I wasn't here when I left.
How come?
Because we were all sitting around here and nobody could decide what to talk about, and I thought it was a waste of time, so I went for it.
Does that mean that you sort of thought the idea of us leaving you to your own devices was not such a good idea?
Yes.
Do you want to say anything more about that? Does anyone else share that same opinion?
Was anyone else disturbed by that?
I was at first until I got something out of the second half. But at first I was kind of mad because we had so much to do. I got as much out of it in the end.
Why do you suppose we decided to do that?
Because you wanted to be happy wife too.
Why else? What was our rationale?
I didn't go to the boat.
What is your rationale?
You haven't left Gerald Street.
I thought you did.
I think that was it was certainly convenient that Susan was here that time, but that, quite honestly, was not the reason why I did that. It was just an added attraction. Because it's about time you guys figured out what you could talk about on your own. And if you guys can't talk or don't want to talk about anything or want to avoid it, then fine. Take responsibility for that and not have Mama Kate and Papa Lori have to sort of crack the whip. I remember when I was a student, when I was first going to school, the professors told you what to do and what to study and how to think, and then they gave you tests, and then you got a good grade if you exactly told them what it was they wanted to hear. You've all done that. You know what that's like. So we wanted you to do what you wanted to talk about, what you wanted to hear yourselves. Yes.
I noticed that some of your
your art was really funny because, like, you showed us some earlier work when you were in school and stuff like that, and a lot of it looked really rigid and really confined. And just like you said, you know, it's kind of like when you graduated from art college, you kind of like grew up. I don't know, that sounds really in your art. I mean, maybe I'm wrong, but that's the way I started to get to know you as soon after you were doing work.
Probably more or less true. Yes, Pat?
I thought it went okay on Friday when we did our own discussion. But I think that this is definitely valuable when you guys are here, and that, you know, I think you're probably joking about the assignments, but that it does help when you're here, and we have those conversations, I think, all day, you know, all week. And so it is important to have a few hours a day to just have you get us in some directions or just to be different opinion or something like that. Mm-hmm.
Do we have those conversations all collectively? Have those conversations all day?
Not in as big groups, I guess, but in smaller groups. Mm-hmm.
Sure, Luke Skywalker could have learned from Han Solo, and he did a lot, but he also watched Kenobi and Yoda to kind of guide him along, somebody a little wiser, even if he didn't
agree
with him.
All.
I mean, you need somebody to give you challenging views if they have worked out over a little more time, so that you can kind of look at those and then decide whether or not they're for you. And sometimes when you have a lot of people who nobody knows exactly where they're going yet, well, then you just kind of maybe get a mishmash, and it's a lot harder to find, you know, things to challenge.
Yeah, however, in real life, you will not have your
Obi-Wan
unless you seek them. And life will have a lot of mishmash in it. And you will have to winnow out a lot of noise from the signal.
Winnowing in the mishmash is a real powerful image, I think.
I just wanted to say that I thought, even though I had a hard time with the discussion on Friday, that I thought it was good. If you did it every week and like twice a week or something, then I'd be a little bit more concerned. But it's not like you're leaving us to our own devices every day and now we're on our own. Ciao, I'll catch you later, you know.
I guess we can't do that now.
And I also, in terms of doing our journals among ourselves instead of having you guys do it. Part of me got really scared when you said that because it's like, oh no, I have to take responsibility. I can't, I'm the one who chooses whether or not I'm gonna keep up with my journal and do the reading that I need to do and all that that I need to do to help me get the most out of this class that I can. And so, you know, when you said that comment about cracking the whip, so to speak, that's where I get, I mean, sometimes I feel like I need that added push of an authority figure, and it's good. I feel good because after I thought of that, I got kind of scared, and I thought, oh no, what if I just blow this week off totally and don't even write anything or something? And then I thought, you're not going to do that because you're enjoying writing your journal, you're getting stuff out of it, and it'll be your decision to do that because you want to do it.
It's your choice.
Yeah, and so, I mean, I felt good about thinking of that after I got over the initial fear of you know, doing that.
I like the idea of changing journals, and I guess I like keeping the same amount of journal writing. I was going to suggest decrease it, but I don't like the more hours I'm going to spend sitting. I want to play. I spend tons of time, and I guess I put most of my time in my journal because that's where it does the best for me, and then reading, and then doing someone else's journal, and then that's it.
I understand.
I'm so tired, and I don't get to play, and that's kind of important to me.
My advice to you then would be to choose somebody who you can be intimate and know fairly well already, so that you can do a lot of your exchange and evaluation orally.
Okay.
You don't have, because that's all right with me.
Okay.
It's all right with you, Kate. Yeah, I understand. In fact, actually, in terms of the reading part, there really is only, we'll be done with Grendel hopefully today, and there's only really two books after that. And then there's that one other art assignment, which actually shouldn't be, it'll be more of a release because it'll be a lot of fun, which we'll also talk about. So the next 9 days, hopefully, we'll have room for play.
Illusions is a pretty quick book, I think.
Yeah, real fast.
I guess.
No, go ahead.
I have like one concern, I guess, floating around in my head. And that's just the, if we share journals, is the concept of confidentiality, I guess. I guess I see that being really important, you know, that if you do read somebody's journal and there's something there that's really powerful or something really risky they've shared, that you know, it's kept between just in you. And you know, you don't tell your roommate or a friend, or you get back to PLU, they say, how's the class? And you go, oh, it's great, I read somebody's journal, and this is, you know.
Yeah, I agree. I think that if you feel uncomfortable that you don't have a real genuine commitment of confidentiality, then either don't do it and just bring your journal to Kate and I, edit your journal down so that nobody sees it, or whatever makes you comfortable
about
it.
Take those pages out. In other words, the person for this week, Monday through Thursday, is only reading this week's part of the journal. And if there's a section that's, you know, really hot for you that you feel really uncomfortable with, you can edit it out just by lifting it out. So you're writing, instead of writing everything on one page, you may use more pages this week. Figure out a system for yourself.
But is that really helping us if we edit?
No, it's not, but I think you need to have the option to do that anyway, because I think my basic feeling is if you take responsibility for your own behavior, it doesn't matter what your behavior is because you look at it. Behavior is a perfect way of understanding who you are. It's when you don't look at your behavior that it's a problem. So if you do what you feel you have to do, then you're doing what's right for you, no matter what anyone else says. And that's the important part of it all. And one last thing, Tom, is that I also feel that if there's some of you who really feel you can't get what you need from trading, or that you're not interested in having anyone see the journal, then I think it's perfectly okay to give the journal to Kate or I and me as well.
With the people only reading what's from this week, is that going to cause problems with, not understanding, because a lot of the journal writing is built on previous.
Mm-hmm. If you are willing to talk with that person, I think that problem will disappear. And nice try.
We put it in the bag.
Nice try, Lisa, but
give it a shot.
Even today, which is a vacation day at PLU, we're meeting, so. But you get the afternoon off.
Gee, thanks.
That's when the store's closed.
If you run out of papers, I'll write down to us.
I think it would be interesting to find out what you found out about your music faves, and do some Grendel, and then do the inner outer in terms of sequencing our discussion. Comments?
Cool.
Oh, what do you want to share?
One thing I found out, it wasn't about my, I found it through my specific one that I chose, but I found a lot of my music, I didn't realize it before, but it's kind of angry. It's not, the way I look at punk music is just really angry at the world, and they just are just pissed off.
Which
one? Huh?
What song?
My song's Refugee by U2. It's not a punk song. And that's where the difference comes in, is that it's not an angry that makes me violent, or that makes me mad. It's like an intensity type thing. And it just, I don't know, it's just music that really makes me feel good and really brings out an intensity. And I didn't realize that about some of that. There's a whole bunch of music that I like that has a
passionate drive.
Yeah. I don't know if that's it for sure, but there's just a higher level of, and there's also a bunch of it that's just kind of bop music that I put on and just jump around the room and dance around and stuff.
Dance is a really strong thing for you to do for yourself. So music that's tied in intimately with dance means more to you than it does to
any music that can make me move is good. Music that I can sit through, I don't like, or doesn't become a favorite.
Uh-huh. We'll have to talk about what all this is a metaphor for, but first I want to say this is real important what you said, I think. Anyone else want to share?
Well, I find the music that I picked up as my favorite was the music that really carries the emotions or the things that go on inside my head that I really can't put into words. Almost the song that kind of have a drug-like effect on me or something where I'm entranced with the music. And it's like I can't really put it into words. Like this music is powerfully emotional or something. It just doesn't cut it like it should. So the music is intrinsically difficult, but it's also yet beautifully simple. How it speaks to me.
How many of you got nothing out of this project? There's an awful lot of you that are just sort of sitting there like bumps on the wall.
I wasn't impressed with I don't know, I wrote down the feeling it gave me and what the words meant to me and how many times I liked listening to it and things, but I guess it wasn't, I didn't feel it was something I didn't know.
What
so I don't know if,
what were some of the details that you pulled out?
There are a lot of different things. Like just liking the beat, it always is a constant energy kind of
constant energy.
Constant, but it still it kind of grows at the end. I guess it isn't constant, but I don't know. It makes me move even if everything I was moving. So I don't know if that means anything, but I guess one thing that I hadn't thought of is it reminds me of a friend that I met who sang the song, so that was something that came out that I didn't think about.
I know for me, you said that you didn't really discover a whole lot of things you didn't already know. For me, that's really true because I have an easier time relating to music than I do, like talking to someone, or, I mean, that has always been my passageway. And when Todd said that about putting feelings and stuff into words that you can't really say for yourself, that has always been what songs and stuff were to me. So it was like almost a natural thing for me. So it wasn't so much a new discovery, it was just reaffirming what I already knew.
Affirmation, self-affirmation.
Try to think of what you can do for yourself.
I found that the song that I wrote down, it really changed depending on what mood I was in. I wrote down the words of the song before I went to dinner, and then I wrote down what my feeling was for it. I came back and I read it after dinner, and I was really surprised at what I wrote. I said, I don't feel like that. And then I was really surprised because then I read the song and I listened to the song again, and I had a whole completely different. So it was just kind of the emotion that I was at the time was the song, and I could fit my emotions to the song at the time. That was really interesting.
You can go, Thomas.
Well, next time, be sure you do.
No, that's okay, Tommy. You didn't know that's fine. Anyway, okay, like what Lisa said, yeah, you really, I guess I really like music. I don't know, I guess. And, but I did figure something out from it, I guess. Is that a lot of times I let a song, or I mean songs with words, not necessarily these symphonies and stuff, but I mean, I relate it to a situation or something like that. Mm-hmm. And I'm not saying that the situation isn't one, well, this one particularly, that can't carry on, but sometimes situations that I relate it to are just one specific one that can't relate to a lot of things, if that makes any sense. But that's what I learned.
I start off by thinking that the song was about one thing. It was the same song that I played here, Bargain, where, you know, I'll pay any price just to win you. And Right. Thought that, you know, it was about striving for something and it was that kind of thing. But then as I wrote, it got more and more resentful and jealous about, you know, not being able to give everything I had to anything, or not having to, or something. I don't know, but it just seems like I'm so jealous of people who have, you know, given everything they have to be a good musician, or given everything they have to follow Christ, or be an artist, a writer, and it seemed like, you know, I'd never been able to do that, and just was almost resentful. The language I started was, you know, starting to get more and more bitter, it seemed, and I'd never thought about it, the song, that way. You know, it was a little bit disturbing.
And that with your situations, are they situations that's already happened, like memories? Or,
yeah, I mean, yeah. But I mean, it's weird, I don't, this one, yeah, is kind of a memory, but I mean, if I think back, situations that happen, I guess they are memories, but it's funny, but I don't look at them as memories, you know what I mean?
Right.
But that sounds really weird, but I don't know, but when I look back, just in all the songs that I've, oh, I like this one, because people used to say, Annette, you, every song is your favorite song. You know, and, but I guess artists would really like me. I mean, but anyway. I don't know. I guess, but that one, now I'm just going in circles. I can't think anymore about it. But did I answer your question? I can't remember.
Yeah.
Not really, but that's okay, right?
What about some of you who aren't saying?
Well, I found it interesting that the song I picked to listen to, well, I wanted this album that the song was on for a really long time, because every song on that album meant something to me, like Annette said, had a memory, except for the title song. And that's the one I picked for my favorite. And I found it interesting that I picked it. And I thought I probably picked it because it didn't have any of these other memories attached to it. And I could just listen to it and enjoy the song without having these other feelings going.
That's interesting that you say that, because I'm starting to think right now, what songs do I really, you know, get into or whatever that I don't have something tied to? Every song that I have has something tied to it. I mean, it'll be interesting for me to go through, you know, music that I enjoy and see if I can, now I'm kind of interested to see if I can find one that I don't. That's very true.
Yes, Marty.
A little different perspective. A lot of people that listen to music and get a lot out of it, just almost can't put it in words. It's the exact opposite for me. I really never, I listen to it, but I don't listen about the words or anything. I just listen to the music and how the beat goes.
Yeah.
And words don't really have any meaning to me.
Yeah, I think a lot of us feel that way about music a lot of times. Did I see your hand up?
Mm-hmm. I found that I like the slower, more kind of romantic, like love song. And it's funny because it's been that way even though when I didn't used to have a boyfriend. I went out with, tell my wife this, I went out with a guy for a long time in high school and broke up last spring. And then when I came to college, third year of the year, I remember my roommate and I playing these songs. And even though it brought out emotions that really hurt and it was weird, and we used to sit there and cry because it brought back these old memories, it was still, we didn't stop playing them and we listened to these classic high school songs. And it was weird, and now I still listen to them, and you know, they don't hurt anymore, you know, and that now it's more of a happy feeling. It was still, it kind of brought out that emotion or something. I don't know, it was like we couldn't turn it off, we hated it, and we'd sit and cry, but we couldn't turn it off.
Was it like,
it was weird, I don't know.
Was it like, oh my gosh, they wrote this song for me? I mean,
yeah.
Those guys are amazing.
It's a good thing I only let her sit there for a week.
Well, this raises some real interesting issues of Someone had a hand up.
Yes.
I thought it was kind of interesting how my song related to my shrine. I didn't notice it at the beginning, but then I looked at the cover and it had a kind of a, just kind of a box that was with the wind blowing through it, and my song was about the wind blowing. And my shrine was kind of open and stuff, but it also talked about standing on a solid base. And I had a brick for a base.
It's pretty solid.
Kind of interesting.
Yeah, that is kind of neat. Anybody else want to have anything to say? I won't name names, of course. What would you like to share?
Well, not connected with my past, but more I think I like the music that I chose because it talks more about the future, about what I mean, what I feel and think.
Sort of your hopes are encapsulated in
it. Mm-hmm. Well, I was listening to my song where I started listening to it, and I spent about 2 hours listening to the music, and I got carried away with it. But I found that it was one of the songs that I classify with my frustrated music, that I play with headphones up very loud volumes, and it's a release for me. It's a way for me to vent. Vent some emotions I have kept up, and also I find that I was listening to it and my hand was clenched, right? I was pounding on the table and my foot, you know, I was even physically released. And interesting point about the song you picked up, should I stay or should I go? And the song after it was a Tears for Fears song, Mad World. And in the middle of the song, Should I Stay or Should I Go, I was really getting kind of intense listening to it. And one of the only reasons why I could feel I could keep on listening to it was I knew that the song was afterwards, it was kind of a dreamlike, kind of hypnotic song that I'd be able to come down or
save you.
Yeah.
So what do we think music's about? Let's see if we can figure out, generally speaking, what music for us contains.
What can you do with this stuff?
Is this
like when we inside dark? Well, no, not exactly. I'm not saying what music is.
Music is art also, Darren.
I
hate to tell you.
Go ahead.
Well, do you want to speak some more?
Yeah, go ahead.
Well, I don't know. I'm just thinking. But music, you can apply it to your life, and maybe it helps you understand or feel better about certain things because it maybe supports that issue or the way you feel about it. And it can be your friend in a sense in that way.
Okay, I think that's a really good point. I want you to hold on to that as we talk about some of these other things. Kathleen, we'll get to you.
Kind of along the same lines, your favorites anyhow. For me, and I think other people, are songs that let you be who you are and let you feel what you want to feel. It kind of provides a comfortable environment that's your own private world.
I hear the word feel seems to keep coming up around. What I've been able to gather from most of you is that there seem to be some central issues that music seems to be about for you. Anger, spiritual love, romantic love. Laura's the only one who sort of mentioned about kind of a hope for the future. But the generally feeling that I have is that it's about the feelings that we don't get a chance to experience in our everyday lives, or feelings, period, that gives music its power and its strength. Release, hurt, pain, sort of grief that we rarely give ourselves a chance to really resolve in our real life, the music seems to open up the door to let us be able to do that. We can see ourselves, we can see God, we can see our lovers or past lovers. We can feel our anger for that we can't express in other lives.
Or our passion.
Or our passion, right, which are closely tied. The other thing, too, is that we get to relive parts of our lives. So many of us, certainly with Kate and I being so old now, we hear music and it often will bring back whole chunks of our lives at one point. The music is not important. It's the fact that what it brings back to ourselves. And some of you have talked about that, and Nikki did, about incidents, memories that are alive today, contemporary, through the power of music that it has. All those things are kind of important. But the thing, one thing I wanted to say about what Chris said too, is anger and how much music really is kind of angry, even when you don't know it. There's a kind of resentful anger about it. What is anger?
Fear.
Fear.
Fear that is.
You guys talk.
Fear that is. Fear that is.
Anger is based on fear. If you're angry, it's because you fear something.
What do you fear? What do you fear the most of? Not specifically nuclear war or something. What are you afraid of?
Something inside yourself.
Keep going.
Something inside yourself that you don't want to face that hurts a lot and.
That's the word. Anger is based on hurt. And I think when we think about a lot of contemporary music, about how angry it is, why are people hurting? What are they hurting about? What are they not able to express in terms of hurt and have to express in terms of anger? And what is the difference about that? When you can't express your hurt, you instead express your anger, what is that saying about how you relate to people? And what is that saying about the kind of music that we hear? I could answer those questions, but maybe I should just leave them as questions. Because I think they're real valuable things to explore.
And the kind of society we have.
You may extrapolate what you will, but I think those are good issues.
Music can access other moods as well, but that's another story.
Mood-altering drug music.
That's right.
I remember that dance that we had here, even with all the power outages and all. I was watching a lot of people do some pretty crazy things on the dance floor. And it's sort of like, I don't see anyone doing crazy things that are here at the moment. And I think that what it really, with some notable exceptions, Yoda here is sort of going on. But music allows us that room to do that. I mean, how many of us will just sort of sit there and then bounce up and down and sort of be weird and have our tongues hang out and say weird things to the person next to us? Because we have this need to release, and we don't find it in our everyday life. Dance and movement is what Kate was talking about before, what you were mentioning. And how, except for athletics, how many of us really get involved in the way our bodies work and how they express. What we think about in athletics is getting strong, challenging ourselves to do better, maybe going into the marathon and competing, but we don't think about what movement does as a kind of more personal expression of who we are.
And feeling good about our bodies.
Kate was saying the next time we do this class, you'd like to be able to videotape all of our postures, because our postures tell us incredible amounts about who we are and how we feel. I think that's all of a sudden everyone opens up to show how cool they are.
Put your hands across your chest so you'll be safe.
Right.
What are you
going to do about it, Christine? I know, you're
white tie?
I said I can't breathe. I said I'm screwed. No, it's wrong.
And you don't want to be wrong, do you?
Sure, I can. That's uncomfortable.
Sort of surrender the idea of being comfortable in class with these chairs.
You're
in a way, my little pink cat, you know, cute and soft and cuddly, and I mean, there's some other stuff in there, but this music isn't cuddly music.
Okay, so it's a different totem for you.
Cuddly.
A different totem for you then.
Well, yeah, it just kind of ties back into what you're saying about the anger and how your music kind of expresses a part of you that you don't get to let out every day. And I mean, I don't really think of myself as an angry person, but it is there. And so this is kind of opposites.
I
think what you can say too is that music is very elemental. You know what I mean when I say very elemental?
No.
Read the Mystic Guide. But since you can't, what I mean is that we live in a world that is real, real head oriented. It's real involved with understanding, thinking about it, writing it down, performance. We rarely live in a world that has very much to do with those gut feelings, with the earth, with the elements. The old fashioned Greek elements, which were air, earth,
water,
and fire. And what those elements kind of symbolically stand for, the myth of those elements, are the those parts of us that make up our flesh, those parts of us that make up the earth from which we sprang. And I think that music is more of that. That's why I think Marty was saying that most of the time we don't listen to the words. We don't listen to the thinking part of music. That's not usually the important part, although there are exceptions. Mostly it's the under part, the part that we feel in our solar plexus, the part that makes our feet want to start moving, the part that puts our minds to sleep, which is one of the things that dance can do, which is why we go crazy when we dance. We don't, we stop and think about what we're doing. We say, God, I'm looking like a jerk. You don't dance. But it's putting your minds to sleep, experiencing something else, which is why I think a lot of people are afraid of music. Why music has traditionally been, the kinds of music have traditionally been repressed.
One thing I noticed at the dance was, I mean, that did not recognize the dance at all.
Yeah,
just
really?
Totally the opposite.
Totally. Yes. Nobody, so cool. I feel like an idiot when I go to dances because I can't not dance the way I dance. And I mean, people like look at me like, what are you doing? You know, you must be drunk or on drugs or something. And I mean, it's like, okay, I'm dancing and everybody else goes like, oh, you know, don't sweat. You look gross if you sweat. Seriously, it's just boring.
What is dancing without sweating?
I don't know.
Awesome. Terry, what's going on there?
God, you're so funny.
Did a lot going along with that. Did a lot for me at that dance. You know, I kind of like, you know, you hold back it. You know, feel your dance. You kind of have to dance cool on. You can't let any, you know.
You can't do anything crazy.
Yeah, you can't do anything crazy. Put in there. And seeing Richard jumping across, spinning across tables, going underneath tables, prancing around carrying a flag, and it just said, hey, anything's okay here. It was a lot more fun.
Richard
was losing
it.
Yeah, he was really
great. That's interesting about the POV dances, because I notice that's true. Sometimes I go there with a few beers and start knocking people around.
I can imagine so.
I mean, not just hit him, but just kind of, I need some space.
You sort of take your room.
So we all go
up here. Yeah.
No.
Uh-oh.
I find that I let Luther peel your dances. I've tried.
No, I mean, I do. But it's just.
You're aware.
After a while,
it's like
you realize that you're
not
getting asked to dance anymore.
Dude, serious.
The thing that was neat about this place is you didn't have to be asked to dance. Why be coupled? Why not just have a good time with a group of friends?
It was fairly tribal.
Okay, this is wonderful because it's exactly what I wanted to talk about and I didn't have to say it. What was the difference? See, elaborate the differences between PLU in here. In fact, one of the people who was dancing that really blew me away is this gentleman right over here.
Yeah.
You met him.
He had a good time.
Except he kept going, I'm so old, and I was like, you weren't, Chris, you were dancing just like everybody else. Oh, I'm so old.
I was tired, though.
I noticed one thing. I noticed how people are, I mean, not only the dance, but everyday life, but the dance, too. Everybody's so much more willing to give a hug up here and to touch, you know, and I think that is so powerful, the power of touch. And at home, it's really hard for me to go back there and accept that if I give people a hug there, it's not going to be the same because they're a little bit so much more reserved, like at the dance. I felt perfectly comfortable going up and giving somebody a hug after, you know, kind of dancing for 2 seconds with them and then floating off to somebody else. And you just don't do that, you know, you. I don't know.
But why? What is that all about?
I want being more inhibited and caring more about what people think. I'm not saying that we don't care what you think here, but it's like we're family here. And it's like, say if you're home with your family and you feel like crap, you can say that. And because we're close, we can say that here. But at PLU, if you walk up with someone and they ask you how you're doing, you know, there's some people, like, when I ask people how they're doing at school, I want them to tell me they feel like crap, they do. But there's some people who feel they can't do that. And you're not going to, you know, just like you're not going to go up and say, boy, this just really sucks. This is going to take you, like, what, huh? All I wanted to know was hello, you know? But here you can do that, and you can really be yourself. But it's kind of sad if you can think about that. Why can't we just let go? I mean, why can't everybody just do it?
I think it all relates back to how we're the capitalist society, how individualistic we are, and how we go on our own way, and we're in our place, and we can't let loose and be a group as a whole because we fear that our neighbor next to us saying, oh, this person is going to get better than me or do something different or something. I noticed that a lot when I was traveling abroad. I go to dance places probably once or twice a week in Spain and France, and you don't go up and say, do you want to dance? I mean, everyone just jumps on the dance floor. That's a good old time. It's set free. I mean, it's not like so reserved and have these manners and individuals. Oh, will you please dance with me? Well, I don't know. Maybe. Okay.
Yes, we can.
Go ahead, Christine.
Well, here it was like we were making our own rules, but at PLU, when you go to a dance, it's not your dance. And if you aren't making your own rules, you're following all the dances chosen for.
Can you make your own rules?
Do you think
you can?
You can, but you aren't going to...
You're taking your risk.
Who was the one who started the dance?
What?
Here. Who allowed...
Start off. How many of us, please, I know I've done this before, but raise your hand, have read Beowulf? Hi, so I can hear. Most of you have read Beowulf. Vaguely remember it. I think maybe
we remember it.
What we might want to do is just, I have a brief synopsis of Beowulf in the introduction to my book. I don't know if you have that in yours. But, that just to sort of give you an idea what the storyline itself is. As soon as I can find it in here. And then Kate has got a whole lot of notes about it that may make the conversations here a little clearer.
I have it underlined here somewhere.
Yeah, maybe someone can go turn on that light. Where is... I can't find it.
Familiar European folktale. Over 200 folktales were identified as having elements of resemblance to the Grendel story. These tales, with all their variations of outline, have enough in common in structure and detail to indicate general conformance to a reoccurring type, which has been come to known as the tale of the bear's son. The name is suggested by the bear-like attributes of a hero, who in some versions of the tale is actually the son or fosterling of a bear. Vestigial traces of this element are to be noted in the Beowulf in the superhuman strength of the hero and the bear-like wrestling of his fight with Grendel and later with Drefalgan, the slayer of Hagel. From the varying versions of the tale of the bear's son, something like a central frame or outline can be reconstructed. Here we go. An aged king builds a hall or house, which is nightly haunted by a demon. The elder sons of the king are unable to overcome the invader, but the youngest son, formerly held in little esteem, wrestles with a monster and wounds him. The flight of the demon is marked by a trail of blood. An episode follows in which the hero fights in an underground lair of monsters, often against a male and a female. His victory over them, sometimes by use of a magic sword, frees captive maidens who return to the upper world. But the hero is abandoned by faithless companions and must single-handedly invent means of escape from the monster's home.
The tale often ends with the punishment of the traitor, the marriage of the hero, one of the rescued maidens, etc. There are over 200 tales that stem from tribal traditions, including violence and effects of fate in Scandinavian lore. A lot of these have to do with discussing savage feuds, prophecy of Swedish dominion over the Geats, songs from the minstrel hall, and other 13th and 14th century tales which resemble alien pagan material which has been shaped by Christians who have rewritten it and sort of had another overlay of this Christianity over. So Grendel is repeatedly identified as a demon or an enemy of God in the Christian version, and the tradition of doom that is found in many of the minstrel stories is overlaid with a heroic war against power of darkness and evil. The person doesn't win in the story against darkness and evil, but he keeps fighting, and that's the strength of the tale. Grendel, the word Grendel comes from Grund, G-R-U-N-D, which in old Scandinavian lore, now this is your PLU roots, notice we're talking about Scandinavian lore, watery depths, bottom, ground, water monster or water demon. And this ties right in with what Lori's about to say.
I grip the back of my pillow here. Sorry, I didn't realize you could feel that. How does this relate to dreams and mythology? I mean, after all, this is a story that's based supposedly on myth and minstrel lore. What is this battle really about? What is this strange, menacing creature from the underworld? What might this be a metaphor for? So when I think about this, the Beowulf story, for me, when I read it, it was about these great heroic people who were conquering the dark, deep, evil depths of where from which some monster came to threaten their entire world. A battle that doesn't end, a battle that is constantly going on, one that you still must arrest your power from this strange and almost always victorious beast. And what Grendel, the book Grendel, does then is try and approach the same issue, the same mythology. Now we're looking at it from a slightly more balanced point of view. What we're doing now is we're looking not at the heroes as great manifestations of godliness and strength, but we're looking at them now as just people who are kind of blathering along in their own way. What do you think Grendel is? Who is Grendel representing? What does this seem to be about as you're reading it through? How did it strike you? Those are the questions that are real important when we think about the story of Grendel. What it's showing you is a story of the battle of the light side versus the dark side from the point of view of the dark side itself. There are very violent parts of this book, very obscene parts of this book in a way, parts that are very distasteful. Yet nonetheless, I feel a certain kind of compassion for the strange person of Grendel, which I think in a way is part of that thing I was talking about with dreams, rather than slaying your dragon, sort of coming to grips with that dragon, to get to know it better. Grendel nonetheless suffers at the end and does seem to perish, but does it really perish? Anyway, we could go on and on about that. What I'd like to know more about now is what your responses were to this book. Kai had his hand up first.
I know, I kind of got lost in the jumble a lot, and then when I kind of picked out a phrase which seemed like it might be pertinent, I picked it out, but I didn't really seem, I didn't understand it in the story, but you asked for what Grendel was. The thing that I pulled out of it, where it says, when the dragon was talking to him, and he says, "You are the brute existence by which they learn to divine themselves." And I didn't see how, I don't see how that is yet, but that's what I
think. Let's have Darren say what he said, and then Kate wanted to continue with the story of Beowulf a little more to clarify some of it.
I thought it was neat how you can see that if you looked at it kind of like an enemy and your home side, kind of like that the enemy has feelings too, and the enemy also is a person and goes through struggles.
Yeah.
You have.
I'm talking about, you're talking about the dark side and the light side. I saw the enemy as a reflection of myself, the human race, or it was a mirror image of supposedly maybe the dark side that is within me. You know, we don't like to admit it's there, but it's there.
Like, how many times have we used? I know I, when on one of my fur aids to help myself, I used the imagery of a monster in talking about the dark side of me that I was touching upon, or that I had fear for, and like the don't slay the dragon. How many times do we talk about our dark side as a monster?
I don't. For me, it wasn't so much thinking the beast within me, but it's the thing, you know, that, you know, my cutting down other people and thinking that I know about them and how they act and react, and so I nitpick on them. Whereas it's really the nitpicking should maybe go on me too. So
maybe you should stop nitpicking.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, but in order to stop nitpicking, you have to feel.
Talk about that one. Good point. Do we want to go through this?
Yeah. Yeah, I think so. The book is very confusing unless you know the story, and the story is a collection of songs and poetry, and it's gone through so many different translations because the originals have been lost. There hasn't just been one original, but it's been an amalgamation of a whole bunch of different stories, and the particular edition that I'm bouncing off of, if you go to England, you can see it in the British Museum, available, the story that Grendel is the mere side of, the book side of. In the 10th century, there were two scribes that copied an older version, and all we have left is what the two scribes wrote. And then an old English poet wrote a translation of the original old Scandinavian text. So, I think what you can see is that in the 13th and 14th century, the fact that the Christianity came in, it imposed, instead of just talking about demons or monsters, it imposed this sort of Christian view of fighting against evil on top of the story. Basically, there are two stories in Beowulf that we're aware of. There is a lot that's not included in most versions of Beowulf, but we can get two stories out of it. The first one is a youth, Beowulf, combating two monsters. And he's victorious. But in the end, the second story, he has a fatal battle in old age against a dragon. In between there, his whole life goes on, successful king of his kingdom. The great hall that we're talking about is the symbol of power that this king, Wulfgar, had, and he influenced many lands. And his problem was he had these two superhuman monsters, and they made night raids. And in the book, I think it mentions something like 12 years that these raids have been going on. And the southern Sweden geese set sail against the advice of Beowulf's uncle, and they were welcomed with royal entertainment. There was at this welcoming that the Danes had for the geese. There was only one jarring note, and that is that a Danish courtier prophesied an evil fate for Beowulf, because when he was swimming in the water with his friend, his friend got into danger, and his friend almost lost his life, so Beowulf can't help him by swimming along with him, because that he almost didn't make his cross to the other side. So he lost the race, and because of this, the courtier prophesied his doom. So sort of like stories within stories here. Grendel came that very night after the welcoming ceremony, and he gulped down a lot of men, and Beowulf wrenched off his arm, and also the claw came with it from the shoulder socket. So you've got the claw proof that he took off Grendel's arm. Grendel fled to the pool, and there are some stories that tell he sees in the pool was just sheer hell. Everyone was rejoicing at the hall. They followed Grendel's blood track to the fen or the swamp. They had a great feast. Then Grendel's mother raided the hall, and she bore off the king's counselor. So this Beowulf had first triumph, And then his triumph was sort of anticlimactic because the mother had in turn and called up another person and really gross, gory situation in front of everybody. So, Beowulf had to go underwater to fight with her. And this, in this particular portion of the tale, there's a real stress on miracle and wonder and digging through all these sea monsters. Beowulf plunges into the pool, he fights off the water monsters, he enters this great hall, and he starts fighting with Freddo's mother. But his sword doesn't work. She has power over his sword, so boom, she gets rid of that, and she has a dagger. So he's sort of casting around, and he finds in this sort of trash pile of stuff another sword, and it was heavy. Beyond the strength of men to pick it up. He picked it up and he slew her. And when he stuck the sword in, the sword melted, her blood melted the sword. So he came up through the water with the hilt. And the Danes were watching the battle from the top of the water, and they saw the blood in the water. And they decided that Beowulf had been killed, so they left, they gave up. But the geese waited. And so at last, when Beowulf came up with Grendel's head and the hilt of the sword, they returned to the great hall and they had an elaborate feast. The next day, Beowulf left, and when he left, the king gave him 12 gifts, which he shared upon returning home with his family in southern Sweden. That's the first part of the story. Second part is after a long reign, there's this dragon motif, and there's sort of the transition in the story, talking about their sea voyage back and the king's long reign and how he's now very elderly. There's a dragon who has been brooding over heathen gold for about 300 years, and somebody comes and steals a cup out of this pile of treasure. And the dragon becomes extremely furious and destructive and starts flaming with flames. So Beowulf is now a king. He's got a sword, he's got an iron shield, and he's got men around him. And so he goes down to the earth entrance of the dragon's lair, and he shouts the challenge. There are three different stages of this battle that he fights with the dragon, and in one case, his sword gets broken, and everybody runs away because they know that it's all over for Beowulf. The son of Westwen, Wiglaf is his name, remains, and he helps deal with the monster. The monster gets his fangs in Beowulf's throat and rips Beowulf's throat open, but Beowulf is still living enough to appreciate Wiglaf, and it implies that Wiglaf is going to succeed to rule over the geese. Wiglaf sits alone at the death watch, and the dragon is slayed by Wiglaf. Beowulf stabbed into him before he got his throat, was the fatal stab, but Wiglaf has to do away with him. So the dragon gets tumbled over a cliff, Beowulf gets a huge funeral pyre, and the treasure is again left buried under the burial mound. So those in sort of very short sketch of the two different stories. Again, there are many different minstrel songs that are entangled in all this, so it's very difficult to follow. It's very intricate, much like a tapestry or a sweater with many different colors coming in and going out. Now, is that clarified at all for any of you what was going on with the monster?
I think it would have helped a little bit if I had heard that before I read the book, but you kind of
tied in.
Because now I kind of feel like I maybe need a book to read.
Well, you've got a few hours.
Smiling at you.
Yeah.
Smiling.
Yes, I see some sharp fangs.
Grendel too. That was Brent's idea.
Anyway, Grendel, although it's written by a guy named John Gardner, who in fact is died a couple of years ago. Was an English professor at the State University of New York in Albany, and so a lot of his books have allusions to literature. And you'll notice in the book itself that there are times when suddenly it shifts to another way of writing,
oftentimes the style of language is very different and the point seems different and it becomes a little awkward. And he's making allusion to the fact that Beowulf itself, the legend, was written by probably many different authors at one time or compiled differently.
So, just clarify for me. Grendel is a continuation of Beowulf or is the flip side of Beowulf?
It's, what it's doing is it's telling you the legend of Beowulf from the point of view of the monster, not the point of view of the great hero.
So it's the same story, but it's from Grendel's point of
view. Right, right. And in it are allusions or symbols that don't seem to make much sense in unless you know that. For instance, the dragon. The dragon exists and he sort of has an interesting dialogue that is practically uncomprehensible.
Right.
And but nonetheless, the dragon knows what the future is. The dragon exists out of time and makes allusions to the fact that the dragon knows he's eventually going to be slain by one of the sons of man, I think he says in the book, and sort of letting, accepting that kind of strange view of fate.
So Grendel didn't go quite as far as, like, Beowulf did in that you get to the dragon, you slay him part of the
world. Right, because Grendel died.
Oh, true. Grendel tells the story. Grendel had a monster's mind, but the dragon was more sophisticated, and so in my edition, the dragon serves as the explainer of what Grendel is to Grendel.
Can we talk about the dragons more? Or
sure.
Are we going to now?
Talk about, yeah.
Okay.
I don't think that John Gardner also is the one who wrote some of the James Bond books after being funny.
I didn't know John Gardner wrote.
He wrote the continuation. Any of the new ones are written by him?
That I did not know.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's a different John Gardner.
I think it must be.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
This John Gardner would not have stooped that low.
Because I thought that this John Gardner, that James Bond one, was still alive.
Yeah, no, this John Gardner died in a motorcycle accident a couple years ago, in fact.
This Gardner is a prop type who'd ride a motorcycle.
He had long white hair or blonde hair. It's a really brilliant kind of interesting, eccentric kind of person.
Dedicated writer type.
Anyway.
Didn't have much to do with
Fred, what about the dragon?
Yeah.
But anyway, what about the dragon?
When I was reading it, I don't know if this is my interpretation, I guess, of the dragon was, the dragon didn't exist outside of Grendel, but it was inside Grendel with the dragon. Because when he went to see the dragon, he just fell in the darkness, and then he's in front of the dragon. And then when he's fighting the thing, he smells the dragon, and he feels the dragon. And then at one point, he's walking along and he goes, maybe I should go see the dragon. But he goes, no, I don't want to do that now. You know, I can't remember exactly where it's at, but what I remember is that what I understood to me was the dragon was the dark side of Grendel. Or the ego of Grendel or whatever.
Interesting point. Yeah.
Again, he's pulling out of the story and making a bigger broad brush picture of one character being related to a second character and possibly being exactly one with duality, two personalities.
Speaking of duality, remember I talk about oftentimes how stories will use a metaphor for trying to say something else. Both the myth and Grendel talk about the same kind of metaphor. And that metaphor winds up being something about, I mean, we've all known that sort of hairy ape image, the kind of animistic thing that man is always battling against. In the different cultures, in fact, that animistic thing was incorporated into their gods, where gods were part man and part beast. What was the fatal flaw, if I can get back to kind of English 101 and Shakespeare? What is the fatal flaw in Grendel? What is he all about? What keeps him going back? Why does he...
His loneliness. He was so alone. I don't know, it read me a book that said that the only friend that he had was a shadow, yeah. The only friend the world gave him was a shadow, and he was so obsessed with the people, he was so lonely. His mom was just kind of there and never, like, you know, couldn't talk and never really seemed like they had very much with him. And he kept going back there because it was like that's the only thing he had to do, really. I mean, he would walk to the forest, talk to the forest, and he was just seemed so lonely. I don't know.
I think it's something self-part of mankind. Felt like he belonged with them. I'm wondering.
So his fatal flaw with his relationship to mankind.
With the man within him.
Humanness.
His humanness.
Why would that be a flaw?
I think that's what ultimately made him vulnerable to being, before, until he met, until he saw Beowulf, he didn't, nobody could do anything. Swords wouldn't work against him. And I think that he was, kind of bored with all that. And, there's nothing with a challenge or anything. He was just, eating people for food. And once in a while, to have fun, but it wasn't that much fun anymore. And he just kind of had this humanness, like falling for the girl and the minstrel. He just finally, his humanness let him believe that Beowulf was something special and that Beowulf could be him, and maybe that's what broke the spell.
You had us, you were trying to lead us to complete a certain ceremony before for...
What do you think? What is the struggle, the basic struggle that happens in the book? It's pretty easy. I mean, you all know what's the basic plot and what's the thing that happens here.
He's alienated. He doesn't feel part of it, so which
is evil. Is it good? Good versus evil is certainly one of the ways we might look at it. What might be another way?
To be the most powerful.
Struggle with yourself in the world.
Yeah. Struggle with yourself. Yeah. That's sort of what I think he's basically about. Grendel is a mythical figure that becomes personified, according to John Gardner. And John Gardner personifies it for a very specific reason. He doesn't write the story of Grendel just because, gee, it would be a real nice idea to kind of tell the story from another point of view. He's doing it because he has a very specific message involved in stating that kind of point of view. And one of the things that he lets you in on in a really remarkable way, although it isn't always easy to follow, is exactly what Grendel's motives are, what makes Grendel what he is. And the thing that constantly keeps happening is Grendel is nothing without mankind. Mankind is not much without the idea of that monster to conquer, which they constantly redefine, whether it's Grendel, whether it's the dragon, whether it's the other tribe down on the mountainside. And so there's this kind of inexorable conflict that is the definition of them. Without each other, they do not exist.
Can I interrupt here?
Please.
What Kai was referring to, the dragon talking to Grendel, just a brief quote. When Grendel is seeking advice from the dragon, dragon tips up his great tusked head, stretched his neck side fire. Ah, Grendel, he said. He seemed that instant almost to rise to pity. You improve them, my boy. Can't you see that yourself? You stimulate them. You make them think and scheme. You drive them to poetry, science, religion. All that makes them what they are for as long as they last. You are, so to speak, the brute existant by which they learn to define themselves. The exile, captivity, death they shrink from. The blunt facts of their mortality, their abandonment. That's what you make them recognize, embrace. You are mankind or man's condition, inseparable as a mountain climber and a mountain. If you withdraw, you'll instantly be replaced. Brute existant, are a dime a dozen. No sentimental trash, then. It demands that your relevance that interests you, stick with him. Scare him to glory. It's all the same in the end. Matter and motion, simple or complex, no difference, finally. Death, transfiguration, ashes to ashes, and flying to flying, amen.
What page is that?
In my book, 62.
That's fine, too. Yes, oh, I have to report.
If you carry that thought a little further, everybody's a Grendel for everybody else, then. Because we all define ourselves by everybody else.
And who is everybody else?
The people who feel you down.
Besides them. All the issues you have with other people oftentimes are projections of ourselves onto them. And so, taking what you just said one step further, everybody else is a projection of ourselves in some strange kind of philosophical way. In which case, the Grendels we battle with are not Grendels that are extant in the other world. They're battles that are extant within our own internal world.
Okay.
So we ourselves are defined by the struggle we have with what sometimes is called the darker side, what I prefer to call the intuitive, non-rational side.
We are defined by our struggle with that.
I think the clock is touching on that.
Go ahead, Kyle.
What is the point for the grossness and that Grendel has to do there? I mean, it seems so extreme that I don't understand the point.
Well, I can tell you what I think the point is, but maybe do you have any sort of inkling about what it might be?
I don't know. It just bothers me because when you say we're a Grendel for everybody else, or there that then it's almost seeming like that there is this that everybody has this, such an evil thing when I don't see people at all.
Is Grendel evil? In some ways, I don't think Grendel is ever portrayed as being evil. He's violent, he's cruel, he eats people, but he's never really evil. And so what do you think that's all about then? He's sort of a lost soul, what he is.
I think a lot of what Carter was saying has to do with contrast. To understand what good is, you have to know what bad is. To understand what happiness is, you have to know what sadness is. We talked about this right at the beginning of the class. You know, you can only be as happy as you know how to be sad. And I think a lot of it, you know, the gore had to balance out, you know, the visions of the girl. I never can remember her name, Richard. And
Or the poet.
You can't really understand the effect that they have without seeing the ugly side.
That's true in the kin of Asa as well.
You'll find it to be true in Narcissism Golden. In fact, it was also true in Russell Baker.
With the contrast, is that what you're saying is in both? I don't know.
That one thing is oftentimes defined by its opposite. There is a book I read once that's talking about an African tribe that they don't have any now. Everything is a state of beingness, so that a person doesn't exist. A person is described by what that person is doing. A person is, everything is described in terms of adverbs. Walking, walkingness, sittingness, sleepingness. And this person was trying to say that the world is not a noun. The universe is a verb. The implication is that things are constantly in motion, never standing still. You cannot define a person in space without also being implicitly aware of the space in which that person exists. Objects do not exist except as a function of the environment in which they are in contact. And one of the things about that the book talks about then, is how mankind and Grendel are inexorably intertwined in that same kind of framework. What Grendel is, in some ways, is that nightmarish part of us. Many of us have had these horrible nightmares that are things we would never want to admit to anyone, things that are about sex and violence and cruelty and horrible monsters and dripping slime and all that kind of stuff. What Grendel is trying to show you is that all this stuff is just part of this personality, this process. It does not exist as evil to be separated, but it exists as something to be understood in context, which does not mean that that's an analogy that evil is something to sort of look at academically and see, but to be able to incorporate that and their own internal battle. Grendel and Beowulf is not a battle that exists there in Finland somewhere. It's a story and a battle that exists inside of ourselves that we project into the world and therefore create a myth.
That's why the myths have survived.
And still has the power. In fact, it's the same myth we constantly recreate. This myth is exactly what the Star Wars trilogy is about. The exact same thing.
And Star Trek.
And that Star Trek issue that you talked about of the good and evil inside of us. I mean, that whole issue is one that we are confronted with every day, all the time. But we externalize it. We think that, there's evil there. What we need to do is erase and battle that evil, and then we'll be done with it. But as in Beowulf, the battle is never won. Because as long as you externalize the battle, then it goes on forever. And maybe even if you internalize it, it still is there.
And sometimes as long as the battle is externalized, confusion
ring.
There was a hand up over here.
Yeah. Here, when I read Beowulf last summer, when I read Grendel and then thought about Beowulf, and, you know, as we talk about dark side or part of it, the dark side is being Grendel or evil or whatever, then I think we're automatically saying like Beowulf is the light side or the good side. And for me, it's not that way because I see Beowulf as a violent person. I see Beowulf as like a Rambo. We get a Rambo for today. And I don't really like the Rambo image at all. I know a lot of people that don't either. Mm-hmm. And my image, I guess, of light side of good is more something like maybe somebody, yeah, maybe not even Shaper though, because he's a deceiver in a way, in a liar. I don't even know if there was anybody in the whole story that really came across to me as what I considered light.
Mm-hmm. There's no hero there. It's
right.
Hero.
It seemed like they all were violent or had, you know, I don't know.
Yeah, I think it's a real good point.
Just from reading the two stories, I almost got the impression that Grendel had more reason to feel the thing than Beowulf had in the manga, but it seemed like Beowulf was the one who was trying to come to grips with everything that he was doing and struggling so hard with it. And it seemed that Beowulf was just part of society. Wolf up on the evil monster and get, you know, his reasons were, and he didn't really think through his reasonings. He was just, you know, trying to move the hands with the man in the car.
So the monster was ridiculous, crouched in the shadows, thinking of dead men and murdered children and martyred cows. But what you're saying is Beowulf also was kind of pointless then.
I think it's
didn't have the wonderful redeeming features of our Scandinavian hero that we look up to.
It's really interesting too that the violent myth that we talk about here, once again, like you say, about our Rambo, is repeated again and again and again. It's not repeated because someone decides to produce a movie. It's repeated because there's a need for it to be experienced. And what is that about? Which is precisely what this is about too. Which is also what Narcissus and Golden is about, is that, what is that part of us that we struggle with? In fact, when talking about that, I guess it's, although the edition, the cover is different, probably the inside is the same, on page 114, when, starting at that page anyway, where Grendel is listening to that, the head priest, I forgot what his name is now. The old white-haired guy. And the old white-haired guy thinks that Grendel is the great destroyer. And so the guy starts sort of going into this ecstatic description of what the king of the gods is. It's an amazing description there in terms of what John Gardner's point of view of what that sort of issue is. And rather than read the whole page and a half to you now, I would just sort of, it's on page 114, continuing on to 115, and it talks about the mystery. And it keeps kind of dragging out the story from that one head priest. And I think that in that right there, it's telling you a lot about the sort of integration of the entire story, looking at it more from a holistic standpoint. Words like time is perpetually perishing, and being actual involves elimination, all that sort of stuff. In fact, you can recognize suddenly when the priest starts to talk, the language changes. It's now not the priest and not Grendel, it's now John Gardner talking, which is what John Gardner's voice keeps appearing. It's a dragon. But the dragon is a trickster, if I can bring that word. The dragon is someone who gives you wisdom but cloaks it in such a way that you can't quite find the wisdom that's there. What happens then is you ultimately seek your own wisdom or give up the quest for wisdom at all, which is part of what the dark side, what our green side always does. It gives us information that is so veiled and so confused in a kind of mythology or in a lack an uncausal relationship with itself that we can't always find that clearly. So he's talking about dreams as well as talking about mythology. In fact, at the end when Grendel dies, he asks, is it joy I feel? Which I think is a pretty interesting comment on what that's all about. Grendel finally surrenders. He succumbs. He stops feeling pain. And he keeps a sense of humor to the very end. Poor Grendel had an accident. So may you all.
relate it a little bit more with the movie that you're talking about. Maybe for me, it will understand more what the need is for seeing it.
Okay, do you remember that Star Trek story that somebody brought up here? Okay.
What was it again?
Oh, the double image. Yeah.
But like with Rambo, okay. Or Star Wars, it's the same thing.
Well, what is Star Wars really about? I mean, if you sort of look at all three of them, but you can look at each individual one of them, really. But what is it about? In fact, they call it the dark side, do they not?
Uh-huh.
And who is this sort of evil person who is trying to enslave people? Who is taking Darth Vader. And who is Darth Vader? Okay, and Luke Skywalker's father was a good guy, right? And then suddenly he got seduced by the dark side. So it's a struggle of light versus darkness. I mean, what are the swords that they use to fight each other with, the swords of light?
What's interesting also about that is one person can feel the presence of the other person. I mean, the force is not, there aren't two forces. There aren't the bad side, the bad force and the good force. It's all the same force. And they're inseparable. There's a dark side and a light side struggling into each other, but they're not separate. They're part of the same person, part of ourselves.
Yeah, intimately bound.
And in fact, the Darth Vader could not have been defeated until you discover that other lurking roots and that rather sappy ending of that last one where suddenly the spirits of Obi-Wan and Darth Vader in his gooder state or better state or whatever you want to call it, are sort of there smiling down with all this wonderful love and fuzzy animals playing there, frolicking in the treehouse.
I can't remember that one. I need to go see it again.
Yeah, I'm the middle one was more of an existential kind of approach because no real answer happened in the middle one. But at any rate, is this any clearer, Kai?
I guess. I have a hard time relating to me what kind of thing. My dark side, I don't know exactly what kind of thing. I don't know if you're saying, are you struggling with it, or what I'm hiding, or what I'm trying to look for? I can't relate it.
What I think that the Star Wars myth and the Beowulf myth and a million other myths are talking about is the idea that the part of you that you don't like, the part of you that you dismiss as being evil, the part of you you repress, the part of you don't want to understand, the part of you that closes you down, the part of you that is what you think is horrible, exists in you somewhere. You all have your own interpretations of it. Maybe it's the part of you that hurts people. Maybe it's the part of you that isn't honest. Maybe it's the part of you that doesn't live according to your moral beliefs. Maybe it's a part of you that does something else. But it's that kind of struggle that, in reality, you are both. And that the struggle between the two of them ultimately is a kind of mythical issue that has been around ever since. And what that means is, I have my own opinion about what that means, but that's what both of those are about. In each case, in most myths that deal with that, the Nordic myths primarily, there is never a victory. That's consistent with most of them, but that's not consistent with all mythology. Some myths say that the only way that is resolved is when, in fact, you sort of meet and befriend each other through a kind of mutual discovery, which is sort of what Star Wars talks about. I have not seen Rambo, so I have no idea what that's about. That's a kind of cathartic.
Well, that's more American in tone.
Yeah. Cathartic violence is a way of kind of relieving yourself.
American person.
But then that's a popular myth too about, I mean, we sort of make communism be this horrible, godless monster, one more time, evil. I mean, what did Ronald Reagan himself say? So I think that's the thing. So we always, I didn't hear that quite.
He said, who cares? He said, what is wrong? I'm sorry. Probably.
He said Ron was a real enlightened guy.
Well, I think he manifests our own mythology very well. And so I think we constantly recreate the same stuff that Grendel's about all the time. And Grendel is what? It was written down almost 1,000 years ago, and it was around for a long time before that. Here it is. Right back at us again.
Yeah, before writing. that's how they preserved it, was through the epic song, and through the repetition, through the chanting. That's how we know what we know about the
I can't see parallels like to, well, like, these are just a couple of examples. Like, you know, alcoholics, or their first step, you know, helping themselves to admit they're alcoholics, to admit themselves that they are in trouble, they're in dark side, whatever. And another thing I thought of was like confession in the Christian church. You know, just go ahead and opening up and saying, yeah, I have a dark side.
And I think what you need to do is to love that dark side in a way. I mean, part of what an alcoholic has to do is say, yeah, I'm an alcoholic, and that's okay. Now it's time for me to do something about it. It's not saying, you bad person, you're an alcoholic. It's a very different kind of attitude about dealing with that dark side, which is a real important kind of message, which is what we'll get, I think, a little more narcissistic involvement. Put your hand up against that.
Yeah, so since we're just... The victory can't be won. We can't do it. What we're just trying to do is be aware, try to look at the different parts of our bad side, just be aware that it's there, but not really do anything. I mean, is that meaning accepting weaknesses, like you said? Is that part of your bad side, or what?
Do you battle, or do you find the balance? Is that what you're asking?
I'm asking if we're just trying to be aware that it's there.
That's one of the first steps, yeah. I think to stop looking at it as a battle, maybe, might be a good idea. Let me sort of reflect a little bit of what Hinduism is about in that very same issue, which I think is real and neat. Excuse me if I'm cutting you off, Todd. You want to say something before I venture off? You seem like you're getting agitated here. What the Hindus say is that if you want to find God, you've got to find your own path. And maybe that means that you're going to be a creepy person. That's okay. Be creepy as long as you have to be creepy, and eventually you'll realize that being creepy doesn't satisfy you, and then you'll move on to something else. If you want to go out there and be in the real worldly place and go out there and make a lot of money and sort of really just value riches, at a certain point, go ahead and do that. Do that to your heart's content. Really get into it and really go for it. But eventually you'll realize it's pretty empty. Eventually what the Hindus say is that you will find God. You will eventually realize that whatever it is you're doing, it will nothing rewards you like finding God rewards you. And so you should go ahead and do whatever it is and really get into it. Of course, they also believe that you go through many, many lifetimes. So it's a process that continues on beyond just this one 80-year period of your own life. But what I think that is a metaphor about experiencing your, if you really do experience yourself and balance those parts of yourself that are at battle, you will ultimately realize that you don't have to be afraid. And I think not being afraid is the first step toward being whole and not creating fear in the world. That's what I think the message behind Rendell is, but that's the message I think I'd like to see. So that's my opinion.
Can you think of an example of the Hindu universe is one, Rendell's universe is another, and that works within us. Can you think of examples within our kind of system of values in our society where going through that process is successful?
Yeah, I can. I was just talking about it the other day. I don't know if I can express it well, but I'll try. We were talking about two people who are having a conflict with each other. And what happens when you have that conflict is you personify the other person as being them, and yourself as being you. And so it's us against them, or me against him, or something like that. And what I was trying to say is that if you accept a couple premises, that number one, that person that you're having the struggle with is not them, but let me put it this way. I read this in a book once, that we are all manifestations of God playing at being who we are. Okay. So if I am God playing at Lori, and Tom is God playing at Tom, if Tom and I have a conflict, what I'm really experiencing then is a conflict that is not an acceptance of the fact that Tom is actually a manifestation of that divineness. So if I accept the fact that there's something here about Tom that is not the enemy but is myself, then I have to say, okay, then my conflict must be about something other than that. It must be about something else. So I have to realize that Tom is not other, it's me. So what is it that I'm struggling with? What is Tom a manifestation of if I'm projecting myself onto that other person? And so I'll start realizing that it doesn't matter what that other person does. It's my reaction to that other person that I have trouble with. And I have to search myself to figure out what I can do in order to be able to ease my own mind. In this particular person's case, this person was having a conflict and could not bring themselves to express themselves. And most of us don't express ourselves for one basic reason. We don't want to take the flack that happens when we do. If we say, hey, I think what you're saying is bull, then the other person is going to say, hey, who do you think you are to be telling me what I'm saying is bull? And we don't want to hear that. And so I realized that what I was doing in that particular case and what this other person was doing in that particular case is not confronting the inner conflict about how to take responsibility for being who you are in that given place. My personal experience is the more you do that and the more you allow people to experience their experiences and express yourself, the stronger you are as a person and the less affected you are by their opinions, and the more you then can present a more balanced model so that the world starts starting to kind of calm down. It happens in relationships, personal relationships. Certainly it's the same thing I experience with my relationship with my wife. It's sort of realizing that this person is a living being with the power and the glory that all of us have as living beings. And we need to allow the space for that to happen. At the same time, we have to allow a space for ourselves and claim it ourselves. Most of the myths talk about claiming your own space, at the same time not needing to impress your view on the next person. I'm getting off into a very weird place, I realize. Is this communicating at all?
I'm tying it in with religious beliefs, values, the way you choose to live your life, how you spend your time, your relationships.
Yeah, it's all part of the same process.
Conflict resolution and business management.
Beowulf style versus Hindu.
I think one problem in our society has, we've got kind of like a Medusa complex. We're afraid to look at our dark side, or maybe the dark side of others. We're just afraid to look at it because we're afraid it'll defeat us, we'll turn to stone. We try to kind of go the other way by not facing it, and try to defeat it by not facing it.
How do you do that? I don't mean to be cutting, but just, I've realized that in myself. But coming across as calm, cool, and questioning with all this stuff, and I'm being insightful, but that's how you guys are
evolving. Oh, I know, because I mean, I personally, that's what I do. I'm sure that's the reason I thought of it, is because I try not to face it, because I think, you know, most of the time that, well, if I don't face it, then, you know, it'll still be there, but at least it can't get me. I mean, you know, and then I'm just afraid if I look at it, well, I'm going to turn to stone, and that won't be any good if I, you know, if it defeats me, then, you know, so I'll just put it off a little way until somebody gives me a shield that I can use as a mirror or something.
Yeah, I'm just really responding to what he's saying.
It's a real powerful issue when you realize that we are actually in charge. Not in charge in the way we think we're in charge, but in charge in a whole other way than we ever thought we were. And so part of that comes back down to the idea of surrender. That you are in charge, and the only way you can take possession of who you are is to surrender for the moment. In a way to sort of let them all percolate down. It's a struggle because we don't understand how to incorporate the dualities that our world gives us, dualities that are constantly there to keep us separated. A good example is what you're doing in the PLU, what you're doing at the college. What does the college do? What does the university do? It divides you. It makes you decide what your major is. It makes you decide what your interests are. It keeps you from being able to be interested in more than one thing. It keeps you from being able to have a social life as well as a study life. It keeps you from being able to be one with your students. You're constantly competing with them. It's all about the same kind of fragmentation. And what we're talking about is a way of putting it all together into one whole piece. It's a real hard thing to do. It's sort of like looking at a huge pattern that's so complex that the only way you can ever possibly experience it rationally is to look at the tiny details of it. And what we're asking you to do in this class, what the Integrated Studies is asking you to do in some ways, is to not think, but feel. So you look at that mandala, you look at the whole, you sort of feel, you don't. That's sort of one of the important ways. It's like I said before, God is not rational. You can't find art by dissecting the brain of the artist. That's what Rendell's all about.
No, I think I just need to cry.
We're passing around right now the quote that Darren read by Carl Jung before. And we're passing it around, I think, because not only is it real powerful in terms of what we're talking about now, I had several conversations with people about being able to give to the beggar inside. Remember that one part of it? And how as soon as I brought that thing up, I felt that inner thing about, oh, selfish. I can't possibly give to that inside. And so I thought it might be really neat to read this on your own. And to remember that Carl Jung was a devout Christian with a very interesting point of view. And I think it might be a worthwhile thing to look at and respond to either in your journal or with us or with each other. I'm real thankful that Darren accidentally brought us along. Does anyone want to say anything? I realize I've been sort of just mouthing off, and oftentimes I don't even know what I'm talking about. I mean, I don't know the words that I'm saying. So I have no idea what you're experiencing. I would like to know what you're experiencing.
I felt sort of frustrated because it seemed like he kept asking questions and I never got answers.
Ask again. Let's see if we can
understand.
Do it.
Maybe that's not true, but that's what it seemed like.
You're in my mind right now. I kind of thought I'll talk to you later.
You were asking about the battles and if you had to keep on battling forever or if you could find a balance, it seems to me.
I guess I got confused when I'm dealing in my journal and things about struggles and fears and things, I don't see those as the dark side, I guess. And as soon as the word dark side or bad side puts in, suddenly I try to think of it and it doesn't, I can't relate it to me. And I don't know if that means I'm not looking at those or that word doesn't mean that for me and that I'm doing it anyway.
Yeah, I'd say it's irrelevant, it's a term that doesn't have relevance for you now. That's perfectly all right. I think the dark side would be the part that I would think would be the part that causes you unhappiness. And whatever that part might be. And sometimes we don't always recognize what that is or how unhappy we are. Even.
Or before unhappiness, maybe anger.
And before that, hurt. I think one of the problems I felt in my own life is that I was never allowed to experience pain and hurt, except as something that I should repress, that I should put down. Sometimes that's part of what that dark side is. It's the side that smells like compost. Sure would like to know what some of you guys are thinking right now.
What do you want
for lunch? No.
Are we done talking about this, do you think?
No.
I know for me, it's been a really heavy day, I mean, for discussion. Rendell is, I mean, it's pretty much blown me away, and so I need time to think about it. I don't want to rush in and give a comment because I need to write about it and just do some thinking about it.
Well, I think the silence of sitting here is good because it makes us think. Makes us uncomfortable, and when you're uncomfortable, you're having to say something. And I don't know. I would kind of disagree with Lisa, with you. I think a lot of time my best comments, I mean, you can even tell.
or when I don't think about them. They just come out. And that way I know I'm opening myself up because I say things. A lot of times I say stupid things. I say things that, it's like, oops, Freudian slip type thing. And, but I think it's good for me and it's good for, I think it's also good for the class when I say those things because a lot of times other people are thinking it and I would hope that the people would open up. I don't see that when I say things like that.
That's true. I mean, I was the same for myself. That's how I felt.
I don't know. Theo and I talked about this earlier. I'm really frustrated. I get really frustrated when I start to talk. And some people don't talk because I don't want to monopolize conversation. And you try to get going, but some people are just not opening up in class. And I really I think that if you can't open up here, you're really going to have a hard time opening up other places. It's a really good try. Even you put your foot out. I meant about saying, I think the spontaneous, because that's a part of our irrational, we don't rationalize, we're not rationalizing our thoughts. And I mean, that's just the responses. I mean, we're starting to touch at things that, you know, we really feel that we haven't rationalized out, so they come out saying perfect. And I think those are, like you said, the most important comments, because that's what you're truly feeling, and you don't try to make it socially, you know, socially acceptable. So, I'm sure they
don't. Can I monopolize time a little bit? I'm going to monopolize the time a little bit because I'm really frustrated. I just spent the last hour writing down everyone who spoke in the order they spoke. There's a lot of, I have L's with circles around the K's with circles for Lori and Kate, and I expect them to say a lot. But I see a pattern of people who speak here. And I know that Christine and I were trying not to speak. I didn't want to say anything during the whole thing, and I only made a couple side comments. And it really frustrates me. It frustrates me that I have opened up in this class, and other people haven't. I feel like it's like, hey, who cares? I mean, why should I say anything? Why shouldn't I just get together? It's like, I like to talk. And get a discussion group together, and I have a list of people here who talk in class. I'm like to say, this is the class. I want to have a discussion group tonight at 10 o'clock. Will these 6 people show up, please? And the rest of you, if you think that you would like to listen to our profound thought, come and join us anyway, because, I mean, you can come and watch, because that's what you do anyway. I mean, I might be a little hard, but I'm really frustrated, because I feel like what I get more out of class when everyone comments, if it's not only, yeah, I see what you mean, or I'm even just little things like nodding your head or being involved. I feel like there's a lot of spectators in this class, and it really upsets me because I'm giving something to the class, and I don't feel like I'm getting, and I don't get anything back. I feel like I'm opening up and I'm trying to do something for the class, and other people are sitting there watching it, and I say this, and it's not a lecture class like a PLU. This is not, we sit there, take notes and fill in the dots and try and analyze your professor. I'm really upset about that, and I'm pissed off.
I really appreciate you.
Theo,
can I say something? Yeah, I think it's really hard for some sharing a class like this or lectures or, you know, just classes like that. And for me it's hard because when I try and express what I feel, it's so difficult for people to understand sometimes. Like I can't really express it maybe the way I want to. Or I haven't had practice, you know, in a large group like this. So that's what makes me hard. But I'm glad that you expressed something like that because it stirs up something in
me. Practice. I mean, if you listen to me, I think a lot of time I ramble on and I say things, I say comments that are important to me, but they're really trivial little bullshit. And practice, I mean, how do you practice sitting there watching other people do it? I mean, and I think you don't need to open up, you don't need to be blabbing on like I do. You don't need to say stuff like I do. I think, like I said, all I care is to feel like you're participating. And then hear you, yeah, I understand that. I mean, I was thinking it might even be a good idea to just, whenever we discuss, go around the circle, and we have an idea, just write it down and wait. And everybody would say, if it gets to you, say something, no, I'm not thinking of what we're doing now. My mind's off someplace else, I'm sorry. just so everybody would have to say something. And that way it would not feel like, oh, they're discussing, I can't be involved in that because my ideas aren't good enough.
I struggle with the same feeling sometimes too. I don't want to monopolize things, but sometimes it sits around and seems like it isn't talking about what I want to talk, so I have to speak up and say something. And I ask stupid questions all the time, but I feel in my ISP class last semester, I felt that the whole semester I started asking stupid questions, and
no question is stupid.
There are stupid questions.
They feel anyway. It's okay to ask them, and I did. But I felt they were stupid. But by the end of the semester, by asking dumb questions and feeling stupid about them, at the end I felt like I was asking some questions that were relevant. And anyway, sometimes in class I want to get people involved too, and I don't know what to do. And I ask people, how could we make our discussion more so you could, do it? And it really hurts me that people can't. And I know it's hard, but if you can't do it here, you're never going to be able to do it.
Reaction.
What are
people thinking?
I was going to say, going along with that, it's just, I feel guilty a lot of times, more than frustrated, because I feel like I'm talking a lot. I personally have to say about 100 words to get 10 out that are worth anything. And so I need, some of you can get 10 words out that all 10 of them have meaning. But I feel guilty a lot of times that, I'm sitting here and saying stuff and I feel like I'm taking up other people's time. But then there's a silence and nobody speaks for a while. I'm thinking of something that I could say, but I'm just saying, somebody else should say something. And I feel guilty, like I'm intimidating just because I'm mouthy. And, that's just, I'd like, it would make me feel much better if everybody was always just trying to get a word in edgewise, and everybody was just, it was more like it was a battle to speak, because then I could feel good about jumping in.
Yeah.
Carrie, do you want to say something?
I have a hard time expressing myself because I'm afraid even if I say 10 words, they can be turned wrong words, and I don't want to say anything wrong. So it's not, I'm sitting here just like listening. I am getting something out of this, listening to every one of you. And it's not, I'm sitting here like a statue for you.
I feel bad because.
You know what? I think that if you said 10 wrong words, I would get something out of that. I'd rather hear 10 wrong words than always have someone give me, here, Chris, here are 10 golden words for the rest of your life. I mean, super. And so I put them on a little plaque on my wall, great. Words from Carrie. And it just doesn't, I'd rather have somebody say something that was wrong to me and made me go, I don't buy that, but why don't I buy that? And that's when I have to ask. I've had people in the past, especially through high school, give me the right words. And it, big deal, they all just came smashing down last week. I would have been better off to have someone say the wrong thing and have me go, and think about it, than go, oh, well, that was easy to accept. We need more wrong words.
Darren and then David.
Megan and Ed have been trying to speak for a while, and I don't know, I think this might be part of the problem, that some of the people that are talking a lot are talking because they jump right out there, and maybe some of the other people are more passive, just kind of raise their hand, and then somebody else picks it up maybe a little quicker or speaks out, then these people get a chance to talk. I think that could be part of the problem. I don't know. And then by the time the other person gets done talking, you either forgot your question or it's not relevant anymore with the conversation.
What do you think, before I get to David, what do you think is the way of solving that problem?
I have no idea.
Okay, I have an excellent, exactly, is that we can't take care of somebody else, but what we can do is take care of ourselves. And I think in that case, if you've got something to say, stand up, jump into the middle of the circle, scream and yell, I must talk. and claim your space. I think the rest of us would validate you if you did that.
Which rep people?
Scream, I exist, I am a person.
But, David.
I just want to say that I agree with pretty much what everyone's saying, but in a way I'm getting real defensive. Only because, yeah, there's space that I talk more than I do today, but I don't like people telling me that just because I'm not talking, I'm not participating.
Okay.
You know, not just, you know, just because I'm not talking doesn't mean that I'm not there with the group. And if I have something to say, I'll say it, you know, but I don't want people to tell me that I need to talk just to make this session better. Some days it's better than others, yes, but I don't want people to tell me to talk. If I have something to say, I'll say it.
Did you guys have something to say before? I think that part of what Theo said that he didn't point out as much when he said it was that it's not so much the talking, it's the feeling that everybody else is here with you. It's, I mean, if you're, you know, if you're saying something and you look around and someone's going, like, you know, and just kind of, you know, or sitting there and they don't look like they care.
They're not risking the same.
Yeah, I don't think it needs to be that you have to talk and you have to, you know, put in your two cents worth. But if you can look up and you see someone looking at you, going, you know, yeah, I'm paying, you know, I hear what you're trying to say. Then that's, I think that there's that. I don't think that it's so much that everybody has to say five sentences.
Well, I just kind of feel like it's, in a way, it's pointing towards me because I haven't talked at all today except for this. Mm-hmm. But I'm in the conversation, I'm nodding my head and stuff.
I think that one thing I really need to say, and that what we're experiencing now is another example of competitiveness and right and wrongness. And I think what we need to be able to do in situations like this is let someone express themselves and listen to it, not to think that, oh my God, it's a punch at me, to be able to listen to what that person feels like.